podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome. It is the Anfield Wrap. I am Neil Atkinson and I've got in front of me Paul Cope. I've got Paula Murphy and Ian Salmon. Coming up, we've got John Gibbons and Peter Moore on Jerry Marsden, who sadly passed away. But we have to deal with Southampton, whether we like it or not. And Paul Cope, good God, that was painful in the first 45 minutes. The Liverpool in general across the 90, I think, just look a bit drained. And it's a reminder that, you know, until Manchester City did it, no one's retained this league title for 10, 12 years. And there's a lot of other things going on as well. These footballers are also living in a pandemic. They're also living with the lockdown scenario. But the first half, Liverpool was just terrible performance-wise. Across both halves, they just looked devoid of inspiration. They looked so flat.
Yeah, it's a tricky one of where to start with it all. For the first time in a long time last night, I got stuck into Twitter, into the mad world of Twitter, and it was interesting seeing what's still going on there. Not much has changed, really. but it was interesting seeing people coming back, and it's interesting how often you get criticised for trying to be reasonable and balanced in these situations. And there's obviously there's obviously a place for saying we were rubbish. But I think more than anything else, coming out of that game last night, I think it's time for everyone to take a bit of a step back and pause and reflect. I had someone say to me last night, it was the first time in his entire Liverpool supporting life that he'd switched off a game when we were losing 1-0. And I was like, really? But do you remember we had Roy Hodgson as manager? Like, there were games when I was chatting to you and other mates about giving up our season tickets then. Like, and I just do think that there is a huge element here of, not just in the past 18 months, 2 years, or a few years under Klopp, him changing everybody's expectations, but this side covering up the few things you've alluded to there. We're in the middle of a global pandemic. These lads have been covering up all kinds of rubbish that's been going on, including not least the fact two of the best centre-backs in the world have been out practically all season. And sooner or later, this stuff's going to catch up with you. And I think what we're starting to see over the past couple of games is, and especially last night in the first half, it just catching up with us a bit.
Ian, for me, I think, and I was fortunate to be in the ground when we faced West Bromwich Albion. And in my mind is the idea that there's a hammer blow in that game against West Bromwich Albion. And it's when Matip goes off injured. And let's be clear about this, Ian. Joel Matip has gone off injured a lot in his Liverpool career. But I've sort of got this moment now in my mind. Liverpool change after that. But they went great against West Brom, don't get me wrong. But they become really, really risk-averse. And these footballers, I think, have ended up having a lot of blows over the course of the first part of this season. And they've shown unbelievable mental strength across the last 2 or 3 years. And I do just sort of wonder if the Matip injury against West Brom just became, and it still remains, one blow too many. They pick themselves up, they dust themselves off, they go to Newcastle. It's a horrible game. They should probably make it 1-0, but they don't. They pick themselves up, they dust themselves off, and then they concede within 2 minutes. And I think this is a really difficult game to talk about in the context of that early goal, because it's yet another hammer blow for this Liverpool side. And they really do take the whole of the first 45 minutes. And Trent Alexander-Arnold doesn't do it at any point to recover from the early goal.
Yeah, I think all of that. I think there's not so much a domino effect going on at the moment as an infinite number of domino effects. Everything is bouncing off something else. From the moment we lose Van Dijk, we change. We're basically, at the moment, we're missing out on seeing the best Liverpool team that has ever existed, which would be Alisson, Trent Alexander-Arnold, Van Dijk, Gomez, Robbo, Thiago, Henderson, Wijnaldum, or Thiago, Henderson, Fabinho, rather, and then the obvious front three. And that would be the best Liverpool team you've ever seen in your life. No two ways. The second we lose a centre-back, we move Fabinho into centre-back. The second we lose another centre-back, we've got Fabinho and Matip. The second we lose Matip, we're either playing with kids or when you get to the point where you can't trust them, you have to play with another midfielder there, as we did last night. But the second you do that, we're not playing as high line. You've got midfielders who are dropping deeper to protect the defenders because you've got a defender who's either inexperienced or not of the quality that we're used to.
And standing by a centre-half and not taking risks.
Yeah, And then you get the dominoes of the smaller moments, like because we have so many injuries in midfield, Case has played far more games than he should have done so far this year and been excellent throughout. Until West Brom, he loses the ball once, plays one careless pass, and that gives them their goal, which gives them a draw that they didn't actually deserve at any point. We were poor against them, but they didn't deserve that point because they wouldn't have got it without a misplaced pass. Against Newcastle, West Brom's in Curtis's mind until the moment it comes off, and he's not playing with his usual surety, his usual arrogance, his usual creativity. He's playing the internal version of himself. And then we come to last night, and we're bringing back players, bring back Thiago, who is obviously one of the best midfielders in world football by a very long way. And if we'd had him fit all season, we probably would be about 6 to 8 points better off than we are. But we play him in a kind of, it's not a 4-3-3, but it's not really a 4-2-3-1 either. And it wasn't really a 4-2-4. So the formation didn't make a huge amount of sense, but he was deep. And that's fine. I saw him play deep for Bayern Munich and win the European Cup doing that, and play as a quarterback. And you know, he can pass ball, but the amount pressed on him in the first 10 minutes, he wasn't used to. He wasn't used to the Premier League being that fast. He wasn't used to the position he was playing. He wasn't used to the players who were making the runs. And his passing wasn't as great as it can be. Became better, but that hampered us. Wijnaldum was pretty much anonymous. Ox comes back in the way he always comes back from injury and doesn't make any impact at all. No disrespect to that, but when he comes back from injury, it takes him a while to get any kind of momentum going. And again, he didn't last night. So every single thing that happened last night is predicated on every single thing that's happened during the season. I was chuffed to see Kopey back on Twitter last night because I was like, thank God, some reason and balance on Twitter.
Don't start that, Ian.
This is what I need.
Yeah. Don't encourage me, Ian. Come on.
But I woke up this morning. Sorry, this long answer to a short question, but I woke up this morning to a Facebook post on my memories from 10 years ago saying, when do you realise you're not good enough at your job and you have to resign now before it gets worse? We're 10 years away from Hodgson going, and people are complaining about us being top of the league. We may drop down to about third, but there's still 6 months of the league to go. And we're 10 years away from Hodgson going, and people forget how bad that actually was.
Putting the past, and for that matter, the social to one side, Paula, for me, what I'm finding difficult to watch, and I mean this from a compassionate point of view, is the footballers toiling. I think that they're putting back-to-back seasons post 95 points. Most of the players who played last night, that's the case. They've been part of that journey and part of that process. And it is difficult to watch them toiling. It's difficult to be frustrated with them, but you are frustrated with them. And it's right that people are frustrated with them, because the big thing that we all want and the big thing that they want is that moment of all being able to celebrate together. And that's what you feel as though is just a little bit beginning to slip away when the performances aren't quite where you need them to be. It was an opportunity last night to slam the door in the face of Leicester City and Manchester United, and Liverpool haven't taken it. It'll be a season where everyone drops points, don't get me wrong, but it was a really hard watch at times last night, emotionally and just almost, for the want of a better phrase, professionally.
Absolutely. The other thing that I sort of thought about as well, and I thought this at half-time, was that goal. I mean, there were a couple of things. I mean, firstly, you could argue that it wasn't actually a foul, so it shouldn't have been a free kick. Yeah. And then the second thing was, you could, you know, if you look at Trent, I mean, I coach football, very low level, but I shouted, fuck's sake, Trent, turn round, or get, you know, and he was spun, and they caught him out of position. It was a mistake. He made a mistake. But the fact that that happened in the second minute, and that we still couldn't engineer a decent revival and recovery, got really more stressful as the match went on.
Yeah.
Because every passing minute, it just felt like this isn't going to happen. And you could see it. Like when I watched before Christmas, the Villa game where we were 1-0 down with like 6 minutes to go.
Yeah.
You had the feeling that we were going to win that or at least draw it. But even from minute like 15, just sitting there watching it, thinking, I can't see us doing this. I can't even see a draw. If that goal had gone in the 78th minute, you know, i.e. Newcastle without a goal, then we could have lived with it. But the fact that it went in the second minute and we still couldn't fix it, there was no inspiration, there was no creativity. As you say, Ox was MIA, Genie was MIA. It was a very, very stressful watch.
On it all, Paula, I feel as though really strangely at the minute, and maybe this is just me imposing that because we've seen it recently, but I feel like our team are missing crowds in general and the Liverpool support more away from home than at home. We've all been in away crowds, and I've always had this thing of, can they hear you really? Do the players really know that we're here? Do they know that we're on their side? Do we know that we're trying to push it through? Like, I think at Anfield, you can't ignore the fact that there's 50,000 people going berserk at certain times for certain matches. But more and more as the season's wore on, Liverpool have only got one away win, and there's a couple of mitigating circumstances. They were very harshly treated at Goodison last minute, very harshly treated at Brighton last minute by the video assistant and referee. But I'm sort of feeling as though when there is a bit of adversity at the moment, they could do with hearing 2,500, 3,000 voices. They could do with hearing that there's a way to pull through. That I really miss not being there last night, just off the basis of being able to almost find a way to say, yes, you're being a bit crap, but come on, we're all in this together.
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I've got no doubt that they hear the crowd, and I've got no doubt that they respond positively and all the rest of it. And you can tell that from the odd time that you guys have had interviews with certain players and they've actually spoken up. You know, when Lallana said to Craig Hannon, oh, you're from the rap. Oh, I'll come and speak to you. They know who you are. They've told you what the crowd means. They've told literally you people what the crowd means to them. So I have no doubt about that. But to me, it's deeper than that. I'm, you know, every now and then I chuck a little article at Josh. Now I'm already thinking I've got me sort of very basic psychology teacher head going on, and I'm already thinking that there's a psychological shift going on from what's called the need for achievement to the need to avoid failure. And it almost feels like psychologically they've slipped down a step, and all those mitigating circumstances, like the consistent denial of stonewall penalties, like the consistent chipping away of decent players that are injured for long periods of time. And it can't not have a psychological effect. And add into that the players. And, you know, the lack of crowd. And I think you've got like a perfect storm of you know, nightmare.
I think you've also got the fact that with the crowd, we don't have the chances in the away team to make their crowd edgy, because we know when we're edgy, it transmits to the players. And if their crowd becomes edgy at any point, and they could have become edgy in the second half, but that's not going to transmit to their players. All they've got to do is focus on the job in hand. They haven't got that external factor themselves anymore.
I think that allows sides to be a little bit more passive. And I think Newcastle's a good example of that, Ian, where I actually think if there had been a crowd in, there'd have been a winner in that game one way or the other. I'd give us three chances in four and then one chance in four. But I think there would have been a winner one way or the other. And the good example comparison of that is the 3-2 back in 2019, when there was a massive noisy crowd over Christmas and the game comes alive and it goes from there. I think in general, Paul, what Paul is in part talking about there is that sort of, is how it has, to me, as I say, I'll go back to what sounds like a really basic sort of thing to say, but they don't look like they're enjoying themselves. And we've got a really recent comparison, I think, on this, when they really do get to begin to enjoy themselves against Crystal Palace. And it's not just because they win 7-0. They're enjoying themselves at 2-0, I think. From 2-0 onwards, they're enjoying themselves. And I do think that there is that at the minute. There is this sort of, it is in part the pressure of it all. I think it is in part, and it's, you know, Paul is right there to mention this, so what they will perceive as the ongoing adversity from the officials. I agree with them. There'll be some people listening who won't. There'll be some people who support other sides who'll feel, well, no, the officialdom's being quite correct at the moment. But The problem at the minute is that the hard luck stories just keep mounting up, and then individual hard luck stories within games just keep mounting up. Suddenly Salah feels like the world's against him again. Trent's on his own back massively because he makes the early mistake. Sadio Mane gets a yellow card because he gets lashed to the deck, and then he's so frustrated he just kicks the lad, which I think tells you a story as well. You can see them, can't you? Each of them just getting themselves in their own heads, going a bit mad, a bit like, what on earth are we meant to fucking do?
Yeah, and I think this is a really important point, actually. I think one of the strongest things from last season, when everyone was banging on about VAR last season, I remember discussing it with you, maybe probably on some shows, that one of our strengths last year was that we just ignore VAR. When things went against us, one of the biggest things we had, which is why most other rival fans didn't notice the decisions going against us, was we'd just get on with it. We'd just be like, it doesn't matter. Put that behind you, get on with it. And I feel like more and more now, there is more, from what Paul has said about the psychology of it all, there seems to be more of us focusing, both off the pitch and on the pitch, on the hard luck story. Like that, the Mane example is a perfect example. As soon as he got up from that tackle, I thought he's going to get sent off here. Because we're into the taking matters into your own hands territory. It's just getting ludicrous. It's absolutely ridiculous what we're seeing. But then off the back of all of that, for the people who want the criticism, and I think it's always really important to say in these times, it is possible to both criticise and be frustrated and be angry and be reasonable and look at all of the reasons why it is the way it is. But we all love him, and he is the greatest manager I've ever seen in my adult life supporting Liverpool. I think Klopp got it wrong last night. Off the back of all of the stuff we're talking about, I think the last thing the players need is more uncertainty. And if you saw Henderson's, and it's dangerous to read into sort of immediate post-match reaction, but when Henderson got asked in the post-match interview about playing centre-back, he did not look happy one bit. Like, his answer was, I'll do what the manager tells me to do for the team. But I think if you ask those players, would you rather Reece Williams just played there? Like, he played against Kane and Son. That he's all right to do that. Would you rather keep Jordan Henderson in midfield rather than make more unbalance in the middle of the pitch? Because when you look at this, and it's funny when people just talk about Liverpool, and it's like, we're not creating enough, we're not dominating. These three lads in the middle of the pitch have never played together before. Going back to what Ian was saying before, we all know, and we don't train with them every day. Oxlade-Chamberlain takes time to come back from injury. He always does. I like the lad, but for me, I'm not sure he's good enough to play the role he plays in this squad, because in his role, he needs to be able to drop back in and hit the ground running. That's very difficult to do. Then you throw in Thiago in as well, who's played 100 minutes for us or something so far. It's very difficult to ask these lads to do what the great Liverpool side was doing last season. So the knock-on effect is compounded by the decisions the manager makes.
I mean, I'll be honest, Paul, I want them to pick Henderson at centre-half last night, because what I think's killed us against Newcastle and West Bromwich Albion is the passing out from the back. In the absence of Matip from about 60 minutes against West Brom, and then all the way through the Newcastle game, it may well be in the end that the manager should possibly have started Henderson there against Newcastle, and then should possibly have gone back to Williams against Southampton. But I completely understand why, after everything he gets to see, and I know it's not entirely fair on Reece Williams in that it's Phillips who plays against Newcastle, but I think that's the thing that he feels. We're going to go to Southampton. We are going to have more of the ball. They are being less intense than they were in previous years, and bar a couple of spells in the first half, they were actually last night much more passive. And I think that you end up from the point of view of, and this again comes back to the early goal, and then you concede the early goal. Because at that point, you're then 1-0 down. And everything therefore feels wrong and feels as though it's not going to work. And in the meantime, your right-back's having an absolute nightmare who's playing next. And all of this, I feel as though, you know, there's another universe where he picks Williams last night and Williams gets exposed a couple of times and he can't move the ball forward as we'd like. And this is back to the idea that every single decision he makes, he's reached the point, hasn't he, Paul, where trying to solve one problem will just create other problems. And that is now, and he's almost got to sit down before a match starts and think, right, where do I actually want my problems to be greater for this one?
Yeah, someone said to me before the game, so I take all those points and I get it. And I, Joe, chatting about it before the game, I'd have probably said, theoretically, yeah, Henderson centre-back, yeah, Thiago in. After half an hour when you're watching it and you're like, and especially once they went 1-0 up so early, and you're thinking, well, we don't need Jordan Henderson to play centre-back for the reasons you're talking about. The centre-backs aren't getting the ball. Southampton became so passive in the second half, we could have changed it at that point. Something else that did the knock-on effect point, which is the where do I want my problems, someone said to me before the game, it's like he's just gone, I'm just picking all the best players I've got available.
Yeah.
And then I'll sort it out after. He sat down with Pep Linders and said, who's our best 11 players? They wrote them down on a list and said, okay, who plays where? And it said, well, it's Henderson plays centre-back and then all the others sort of drop in. Let's do that. And I understand that. I get it. But going back to the knock-on effect thing, I think a point that I've not seen many people make, and this actually led to the free kick and the right at the start, is just take it. You've already lost two, I'd say three of the best centre-backs in the world. I think if Joel Matip stays fit, he's one of the top 5-10 centre-backs in the world. Then on top of that, which no one sort of mentions enough, you are now losing two of the best centre midfielders in the world.
Yeah.
Because they drop back. But not only that, what you're losing in Henderson and Fabinho in the middle of the pitch is height. And something I noticed, I haven't seen the stats of this. I'd love to see the stats of aerial duels in the middle of the park, because we had three short lads playing centre midfield. And it just watching with my eyes, going back to the stuff we say with Joe on the review with Sean, without any stats, we kept losing headers. We kept losing headers in the middle of the pitch. And that has a knock-on effect to your whole game. Because now, things that you don't really notice in a game of Henderson or Fabinho in the middle of the pitch winning a header and putting you on the front foot, well, now you're losing that ball. And now not only you're not on the front foot, you're on the back foot. That's a huge knock-on effect to have.
On that early instance, Ian, there's the two free kicks very, very quickly back-to-back and they almost do everything in. Thiago's one for the goal. Trent, really, really poor for it. Immediately afterwards, Thiago then, he kicks off on the referee. It's probably not a free kick, I don't think, the first one. He then does a tackle that is probably a yellow card tackle and gets an emphatic yellow card for it from the referee. The referee himself is dreadful throughout the rest of the match, without going into detail on him too much. Trent never, ever recovers. And now Thiago's got to be very much on his best behaviour for the rest of the match. All in 3 or 4 minutes, it does not knock Liverpool sideways and the 1-0 down.
Yeah, completely. I mean, as I was saying before, the position that we played Thiago in, he was playing the six where he's expected to tackle, so he had to be completely on it for the rest of the game. For a lad who has literally played 100-odd minutes for us and is only just coming back from a major injury, that's a hell of an ask. And the fact that he actually grew into the game and got better during the second half, I thought, you know, shows his quality. Trent, obviously, it got in his head. And Trent has played stupid amounts of football the last 2 or 3 years and been absolutely crucial to everything that we do. And he's allowed one off night. He got that one off that off night last night and obviously hated every second of it, hated being subbed. He knew how bad he'd been. It's a hard one. If you're going to give somebody a goal 1 or 2 minutes into the game, then you've got a lot to come back from. The way we're playing at the moment, that 1-0 was always going to be hard to come back from. They did lose us the entire first half. Second half, I thought, after 15 minutes, there was no way we were ever going to score. So it's the mentality. As Paul was saying about the psychology of it, we've now got something that we don't want to lose. We're actually, despite the fact that Jürgen at the beginning of the season was saying that we're attacking the league, we're not. Mentally, we're defending the league at the moment. And we're looking at positions where people are crawling up on us and there's a possibility we might lose our league at the end of the season. And that's going to get in the players' heads. You can't avoid that. So everything's in everybody's heads. But those two free kicks at the beginning, that early booking. And, you know, I will go further. Andre Mariner was being what Andre Mariner always is whenever he referees us last night. And it was yet another shockingly inept performance. That's obviously just my personal opinion, but that's how I feel about
it. It's worth saying, Paul, that the foul line's getting ridiculous. And other than a couple of bright spells in the first half, we don't really attack that well. But the fouling does feel as though it's getting ridiculous. There's the one where it cuts to, and yeah, the ball might have gone out, but Jack Stevens has got his arm around Mo Salah's neck, literally around his neck. And even if you don't give a free kick, I'd have no problem whatsoever if the referee didn't give the free kick, gave the throw, but gave Stevens a talking to and said, you can't do that, because you can't do that. And it feels as though there's this real desire to even up a lot of the time with these Liverpool players, because they do use the bodies. They are physical footballers. And we've got to remember that as Liverpool supporters as well. Salah and Mane use their bodies a lot. And they use them to try to knock opponents off balance. But what opponents are doing to Salah and Mane at the minute is, for me, just repeatedly fouling, and they're getting away with it from the officials.
And the reason they're repeatedly fouling is because they're repeatedly getting away with it. Yeah. And, it's not going to stop until we get a couple of penalties. And I think statistics, if you imagine Southampton's team meeting, fact number one, Danny Ings would have been up there giving it the big one, telling them all the inside track. So they had Danny Ings telling them what to do. Second thing is they've got weeks and weeks and weeks of stonewall examples of where we should have had penalties and we haven't. Now, this Man United penalty thing is driving me nuts. So I tried to like disengage and I thought, why is it happening? And when I mentioned this in the weekend of last week, when we're moving the ball around, what I've noticed is where we would normally strip it right down the side through Robbo and through Trent, what we're doing is we're getting to the edge of the box and we're cutting it back and we're trying to thread it in through the centre of the box. Well, at that point, if you watch, most opposition defences have got five people very tightly packed together, sticking a foot in. Our attackers have got their back to the goal.
Yep.
So when they're backing into the player, they're using their arse, they're using their shoulder, and they're not getting it. Man United are getting it because they're running forward. They're running forward, and it's so easy to stick an elbow out and send someone flying to give a penalty. We're looking like, in a lot of instances, it's like netball, it's called cause and contact. It's exactly the same thing. And it goes to the opposition. So you think someone smacked you in the face and the foul goes against you because you're causing the contact. And I just think the way we're threading that ball through and often it's not being successful is the reason why we're not getting all these. That handball, by the way, was a joke. That was a joke. But everything else, I think we're making it easy for refs.
On it, Ian, I've put in the agenda Mane versus Kyle Walker against Manchester City. Mane is carrying the ball at pace. He runs at Kyle Walker. He puts the ball past him. Kyle Walker does what a lot of defenders would do in that situation. This isn't a criticism of Walker, and he just makes a bit of a gesture towards Mane. Mane hits Walker, referee, straight away penalty. Got to give that one because you've impeded the player. He was going to run onto the ball. What Paul is saying there, I think, is an accurate thing, and it's why I don't think it's necessary. I know we all lose our heads, but it's not in our interest to talk about penalties from other teams because there's... whilst they are contentious decisions, they are behaving in a way that makes it easier for the referee to give the contentious decision in their direction because there's forward momentum. And I think that this is the thing that we're, I think in part, sides are more front foot, not just against Manchester United, but against Everton, against Leicester. There's this feeling that we should be more in the game, so we're more front foot. Leicester have had more penalties than Man United this season. And one of the reasons why Leicester get penalties is they're bursting into the penalty area. We set up camp in the penalty area and around the penalty area and then get kicked and pulled and pushed and elbowed and headlocks, and then we don't get the free kicks. We're not bursting into the penalty area.
No, I think it was Andrew Beasley put the stat up last night that was the third game week running where we've had more touches in the penalty area than any other team in the league and not won the game. And we are getting possession. And it is, as Paul said, it's with our back to the ball. It's with our back to the goal. We're not doing it in effective areas. And I think part of the reason for having Ox in last night is he is the player who will burst from deep and just run straight forward. And obviously he's not in a position to do that yet, but we need to be moving forward. I know... trend on Twitter this morning was Jürgen, and all that's trending on Twitter. The only reason Jürgen's trending on Twitter is because United fans are talking about his penalty quote. And we've had one less penalty than United this season. But the annoying thing is watching United's penalties and going, we didn't get that one last week. We didn't get that one last week. We can't be bothered about what penalties they get. We just need to be bothered about the fact that we're not putting ourselves in the positions. So if Pogba's running into the penalty area and he's taken down, why haven't we got Mane running to the penalty area in the same way? The fact that Mane should have had an absolutely stone-cold cast-iron penalty last night is neither here nor there in this example because it was in a position where we never get them. So we need to be in a position where we do get them.
There's on this, Paul, there's a big question here, which is whether or not actually we're being quite well defended and that other sides aren't being as well defended, that at some sort of point, one of the things that will happen with a couple of the sides who are currently riding high in the table, even if it is with a relatively low points per game, is a lot of sides say, you know what we're going to do? We're going to drop 10 yards even deeper and we're going to let you play on the edge of the area the way in which we do with Liverpool, the way in which we do to an extent with Manchester City. City being blunted at times this season as well, although they're coming alive a little bit now. But we may have to acknowledge that this is an example of being well defended. That side, the number of times last night, and I don't think we exploited it enough, Jack Stevens dropped 3 or 4 yards deeper than his own offside line to try to anticipate something. And I thought that was something we could have played in a little bit better. It's partially panic, but I think it's also partially, no, this is where you get set against Liverpool. It sounds mad, but you get set 8 yards away from your own goal line because that's how you'll end up making it hard for them because they'll get to 8 yards away from your goal line. So you might as well almost be there as a start point.
Yeah, and I think, because I agree with everything that, that you're all saying about the, you know, the way in which United get penalties and the way we don't. But the reality is it's because Man United aren't as good as us. So when teams play them, they have the opportunity to run into the box. When teams set up exactly how you've just said, where are you making those runs from? Because you've already got the ball 25 yards from goal. So it's like, well, what's our choice? And it was really interesting. I think I might have mentioned this on Talking Red yesterday with Robbo. It's really interesting watching Klopp and Guardiola. And it's weird because, again, simultaneously, I have sympathy for them. But then say, well, this has only happened because you've created football teams that are so good. Is that Klopp said before one of the games of the week, when asked in a press conference about prepping for a game, and he said, yeah, we watch 3 or 4 games of the opposition before we play them. But then he basically said it's a waste of time because the way they play in the 3 or 4 games before they play us is completely different to how they play us. And that happens to us and City. Why? Because we're so good. Man United, and this is both, again, a lovely thing to say because of what we've watched our whole lives with United being great, and a frustrating thing to say. Man United aren't as good as us, so teams set up against them differently. West Brom aren't setting up against Man United the way they set up against us and City because they're thinking, we could get something from this game. There's a chance of us getting something, there's a chance of us winning, so we can just play our natural game, which gives United the space to run into. With the players they've got, they're going to exploit that. What we're doing is exactly what you're saying. Up against this setup, it's difficult.
Just on that, a really good example is actually, and it could be that to an extent of learn from it, but I actually think there's a comparison. I watched Southampton versus Man United earlier this season. Southampton were 2-0 up at half-time and United were dreadful. And then second half, Southampton kept playing and kept playing and kept playing, and then United made it 2-1. And then it was all United for the rest of the game. They got a really easy chance and made it 2-1. And the reason why Southampton kept playing was they had the idea, Paul, that we can beat these. It's on here. We could go on and make this 3 or 4. Last night, the 1-0 at half-time against Liverpool, and they come out second half and they barely go into our half. They just sit on their edge of their own penalty area and say, what we have, we hold. That could be in part them learning from the result against Manchester United, but it could also just simply be, no, we're coming up against this Liverpool side here. 1-0's fine. If we're all honest about it, we probably take 1-1.
Absolutely. And look, I don't think enough is being made of the fact that their manager at full time falls to his knees. Bear in mind, this is not the Champions League final. This is just a home game.
A home league match. 17th game of the season.
Yeah, middle of the season. It puts his team 4 points off the league. This is not to avoid relegation. This is not to win the league. This is not to win a cup. He falls to his knees and cries. He cries because he's just beaten Liverpool. And some people said to me on Twitter, yeah, but it's always been like that. And I'm like, no, it hasn't. Not to this extent. Like, that, what it means to these teams to beat this Jurgen Klopp Liverpool is everything, and rightly so, because last year, and we've all lauded them for it, it's the greatest football team I've ever seen. At this point last year, and this is why it's so hard, the expectations have been shifted so much. What were we, 25 points clear, 20 points clear? It was insane how good this football team was last year. And that's what it does to the opposition. They want to win so much. They're prepared to sacrifice the way they play. They're prepared to do different things. And when they get a result, and again, let's face it, it was a 1-0 win with a goal in the second minute. They had one other chance, I think. The rest of the game, we just dominated. And the reaction to that win, to the result, is so emotional. That puts into context for me what we're up against. And it's worth saying as well, I've been talking for a long time, but it's worth saying, even with all of that stuff we were saying about running to the box and United and blah, 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 we had the Mane one on Kyle Walker-Peters, which there's another side point on this, by the way, that I think people have criticised. There's so many ex-Liverpool players as pundits. Sometimes that goes against you because there's an onus on them to try and look reasonable. I think if Jamie Carragher's watching that in the pub with us, he's going, that's a pen. The way Ian analysed it was, yeah, Walker-Peters put his legs across and then Mane kicks him. I'm like, yeah, that's all fouls, isn't it? That's all fouls. you put your leg in front of me. I kick your leg. I go down. You didn't get the ball. It's a foul. Then you had the Milner one with Walcott, which it's just, for me, it's insane that and then the handball. I've seen a few people on Twitter saying a similar thing. Craig Cannon said it. I don't know what the rules are anymore. If a defender in the box diving with his hand away from his body and handling the ball isn't a penalty, then where are we? And when you saw Klopp's, I think that the knock-on of this, again, of why do we get so pissed off? Klopp summed it up when he said, he turned to the fourth official and said, are we not even checking that? And it's like, we've already checked it, mate. And you can see him going, well, do you know when we did the check on Fabinho's one the other week? We took 20 minutes. Like we made sure we analysed it. You've literally called some of my lads offside by like hairs under their armpits because we've analysed it so deeply. And this is just, yeah, we've looked at it, mate. Don't worry about it. Play on. And I think that's where we've got. That's why it becomes so frustrating.
We'll talk more about what Liverpool need to do next in a minute or two, and in general in the Anfield wrap across the next few days and weeks leading into the Aston Villa game and looking at, we're about to talk in a minute about the heart of the Liverpool defence, all of that sort of stuff, and analysing how Liverpool have got to here and what they should do next. All of that is available on the Anfield wrap. Download the app. Go to theanfieldwrap.com/subscribe. There's writing on the website as well. Check that out. Paul mentioned Talking Reds, which you can watch on YouTube if you don't already. That is available for free, and there's all of our other video content as we go right the way through the season. Do check everything out on the Anfield Wrap. We're not going anywhere despite the ongoing life situation, which has changed back to where it was in March. The Anfield Wrap will continue to be putting the work together and getting it out there for you to be a companion through the rest of this Liverpool season. Aston Villa in the FA Cup, the run into Manchester United in the league, followed by the big game, as it will be, against Burnley, and then a massive game against Tottenham Hotspur. All of that to come. Do subscribe, theanfieldwrap.com/subscribe. But here is John Gibbons speaking to Peter Moore about Jerry Marsden.
And it is John Gibbons for the Anfield Wrap, and I'm joined over Zoom by the former CEO of Liverpool Football Club, Peter Moore, to reflect on what was a sad weekend for the football club. And Peter, I was reflecting on this, and normally when we're talking about a sad moment, it's a player that we lose or someone from the management. And there's only really one singer who's so ingrained within this football club that it'd be used in a similar way. But that's who Jerry Marsden was. And it is a really sad loss to the football club and, of course, to the whole city itself, this sad news over the weekend.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you're right. I mean, normally we're, you know, unfortunately mourning the loss of players from our history. But as a few people pointed out over the weekend, this is our 12th man. This is the man's voice that we all hear prior to us kicking a ball at Anfield, you know, every game, and has done for half a century, and an incredibly important part of the football club, a great friend of many of the former players, who all, as you saw, John, poured in with their sentiments, and equally importantly for the city. I mean, this isn't just about You'll Never Walk Alone, but Ferry Cross the Mersey and all of the great songs of that period of the 60s of the Mersey beat when, you know, Liverpool ruled, you know, the music world. And his sentiments, you know, you think of the lyrics of Ferry Cross the Mersey, you know, we don't care what your name is, you know, and it really, I think, exported Scouseness, Liverpudlianness around the world. And whilst we always give the Beatles credit for that, Jerry Marsden, Jerry and the Pacemakers equally did a ton to support what people now link Liverpool with, which is a great music city.
Yeah, it was. First three singles all went to number one, and it was an incredible achievement. But obviously, You'll Never Walk Alone is the one that the Liverpool fans all around the world now celebrate. And he was really proud of that, continuing links with the football club. And I know you spent some time with him at games, and you shared a wonderful video, which is why I reached out to you, of his beaming grin as his song all those years later was still resonated around the club. He looked proud as punch.
Well, and he was. This was October 2018, and Steve Rotherham had pinged me and said, you know, it's the 55th anniversary of You'll Never Walk Alone going to number one. Let's get Jerry to the game. So I reached out to Jerry, got on the phone with him. I said, it'd be wonderful if you could come and join us in the boardroom, join us in the director's box, be there for the game on the weekend that You'll Never Walk Alone went to number one. And of course, he jumped at that. We had such a great day. You know, his impish, you know, personality. He brought his wonderful grandson, John, as his plus one. And Jerry was the life and soul of that boardroom. People loved having him there. I got him on the microphone to say a few words. And pretty quickly, he's cracking jokes and everything you would expect from Jerry Marsden. And this is only 2 years ago. So it was, you know, I'm here in California, and I woke up yesterday morning to this just horrific news that he passed away. It was so sudden, such a shock. And you're right, we've lost one of our own. And not only from a football club perspective, but an incredible exporter of Liverpudlianness around the world.
Yeah, and everyone who met him says sort of similar to you, really, that, you know, he was enthusiastic to meet new people. He was charming and just had that natural entertainer about him.
Yeah, I know. And it's funny, one of my cousins, when I posted on Facebook, told me a story that he was putting an aerial on his roof. This is decades ago. And something about a three-legged dog, I don't know what that is, that Jerry had as well, which sounds like Jerry. But Jerry offered him a tip, and my cousin Paul said, no, that's fine. I don't need a tip. But Jerry got up the ladder and put a tenner in his work boots. And that's just indicative. That's just one little anecdote from within my family that I read that is just indicative of what Jerry Marsden was. And, you know, his wonderful wife, Pauline, his daughters and his grandchildren, we'll all miss, as we all will, the football club, the city itself. And, but I think, you know, if there's a legacy that he will have, is that his voice will always be heard before we kick a ball. And George Sefton will make sure of that. And I think it's going to be, when we all get back together again in Anfield, and when that first You'll Never Walk Alone kicks in, it's going to be a really poignant moment.
And that's an amazing legacy to have, isn't it? Because You'll Never Walk Alone won't just outlive him, but it'll outlive all of us.
Absolutely.
You know, and that's an incredible thing. You know, how many people can say that in their lives, that's what they achieve?
Yeah, I mean, and as you know, it's not just us, although it's our song, but Celtic and Borussia Dortmund and football clubs around the world in tough times have all gravitated towards that song. And when I, you know, in my three seasons at Liverpool, and I traveled the world, you know, primarily Europe, and when great clubs arrived to play us in the Champions League, Barcelona, Bayern Munich, PSG, all in speaking with their executives in advance, they all say, I cannot wait to come to Anfield and hear You'll Never Walk Alone. And so that's, you know, his voice and that legacy makes, and there's a lot of other things that come together to make Anfield such a unique and special place. But that rendition of You'll Never Walk Alone at the beginning, and then, you know, at the end, sometimes when we feel the game's in the bag, we then will sing it again a little precariously just in case things go wrong. But, you know, it is something, and I'll never forget, for example, Barcelona, you know, the renditions of You'll Never Walk Alone there towards the end. It's both a rallying cry and almost a gospel anthem for all of us around the world.
And have you found as well, is something, Peter, that has almost attracted a lot of people to the football club in terms of, you know, because you've travelled a lot with the club, and we've been lucky enough to be alongside you on many of the occasions. And, you know, when you ask people, what was it attracted you to Liverpool? You know, they talk about the players, and they talk about, you know, depending on how old they are, you know, famous nights, but also this anthem really resonates with people, don't they? And it's the kind of person who believes in maybe unity and maybe, you know, being sort of stronger together. There's something about that anthem that really means that Liverpool is able to appeal to them in an extra special way.
Yeah, I mean, it's spiritual. I mean, there's no other way to describe it. The words themselves are brilliant. Obviously, it's a Rodgers and Hammerstein song from Carousel. And Jerry told a great story about a rainy day in Liverpool and going to the cinema. And the second part of the doubleheader, the first one was Laurel and Hardy. The second one was Carousel. That's when he heard the song.
Oh, wow.
I said, we've got to record this. And his bandmates and Brian Epstein said, no, that's not what the Mersey beat was. But thank goodness, you know, Jerry prevailed and history was made. But you're right, as you travel the world, and I've always said this, people, you know, Liverpool fans or just football fans in general, they don't just say, I want to go watch Liverpool play. They say, I want to come to Liverpool. I want to come to Anfield.
Yeah.
And drink in and absorb everything that is part of that Anfield, that unique Anfield experience. And no disrespect to other football clubs around the world, but you never hear that. I want to come to this particular stadium. There's a few, but nothing like Liverpool. And part of, if you will, the ceremony, if you will, the hymn sheet that comes out, it's like, coming to Anfield is like attending a church service in some elements of it. And there's the hymn sheet, and it starts off with You'll Never Walk Alone and George Sefton cranking everybody up. And, we've got our list, right? Fields of Anfield Road, and it just goes on. And it is almost like a church service. And You'll Never Walk Alone kicks everything off. And yes, people are just desperate to be part of that at least once in their lives.
Something that you were really good at when you were CEO, and I can be nice to you now because you've left. Something you were always really good at, though, was talking about pushing Liverpool forward and making sure Liverpool were a modern club and were forward-thinking and being you know, the best we can be commercially so we can see that success on the football pitch, but also linking obviously with the past and, you know, people like Jerry Weir, that past. And
yeah,
it was a sad day, I'm sure, for you yesterday, but you must have also reflected on, I was so glad that it gave Jerry that day, because I'm sure he was well looked after by everyone at the football club, not just you. And so you must have reflected on that yesterday and thought, I'm really pleased that, that we did that for Jerry and gave him, you know, the red carpet treatment that he deserved.
Yeah. Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's one, you do look back and you reflect upon the fact that that was, I think, the last time he ever came to Anfield. And you know, that Steve Rotherham had had the foresight to do the calculation of 55 years and that we got on the phone and I chatted with him. He left the boardroom. He was one of the last to leave at the end. And of course, I'm sure we won that game as we always did. But he was beaming. And you can see in that video, which Debbie, my wife, took and just, you know, one of those moments you just lean across with your phone, and we all do it almost every day. But the pride and the beaming and his head held high, and, you know, his voice isn't maybe what it was, you know, 50 odd years ago. But you can hear in the video as he hits those high notes, it's still there. And just a big beaming smile. And I don't know if you saw, you know, like a fist pump as the crowd kicked in. And having that, being 5 feet away from that, as much of all of the great moments I had over the last 3 years on the pitch, watching on the pitch, to be able to facilitate that, to experience that, and to give somebody who has been so important to our football club that memory. And can you imagine if you had recorded a song and then you're in the stadium and 54,000 people are singing that song, the pride, I mean, you can see it in his face. And the people around us also all just big smiles that we knew we were experiencing an incredibly special moment.
It's a lovely memory, and thanks so much for sharing it. And thanks for coming on as well. I really appreciate your time, Peter.
Thank you very much to Peter and to John for all of that. I actually think Paula, Henderson and Fabinho actually both do pretty well on the night. And if anything, that made you yearn for them even more in the middle of the midfield. There is now no end to the number of centre-halves I would like Liverpool to buy. Picking Henderson suggests he doesn't want to pick Phillips or Williams in there in a game that's slightly tougher than average, but where he also feels like Liverpool will have the ball. We've got to acknowledge that, but what that means, Paula, is Liverpool have got to be going into the transfer market for a centre-half. I would actually argue they should be looking for one that they fancy as a long-term option and maybe looking for one that they could do as a cheaper or loan short-term option so that they don't have to return to at least Henderson, but ideally Henderson and Fabinho playing there.
Yeah, playing Williams and Phillips over the last couple of games, one by one, has made everyone sort of realise, yeah, they're not, there's a gap, and the gap is too big between even Matip, who, you know, 2 seasons ago we would have, you know, quite happily sort of called our fifth favourite. Going on Twitter, like Paul said, I had a little look and I saw that there's quite a few shouts for Lovren and then quite a few shouts for behave, will you? There is a gap. The gap's too big. I agree totally with what you said about playing the 11 best players. And I think Fabinho was, I'm not going to say he was anonymous. He wasn't anonymous, but he was just doing all the donkey work. And I think watching Henderson, all he was trying to do, he could see Trent said had gone, I think. He could see Trent was having a nightmare. He was trying to support him, scream at him, marshal him, protect him, all of those things, which is absolutely sensible as to why we weren't getting any passes out from the back to any great degree to help our midfield. So, yes, I think we do. I think what the shout is today as compared to what it was 2.5 weeks ago, is a world away. I mean, I'm not a great European defender. I mean, the other issue as well is Saints even were without Vestergaard. So even without their best central defender, they still did us. So that's another sort of slight mini layer of a problem that we need to solve next time. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I wonder if he'll get rid of Phillips in January, because clearly he's not the answer. And is he going to go for two or is he going to go for one? I think we're a lot better of a proposition for someone to know that they're going to spend a lot of time on the bench, where we perhaps weren't 2 years ago. But I think 2 weeks ago, I would have thought he might go for a stopgap. Now I think completely different, and he's going to have to look for an equivalent, really. I think so.
Ian, he's got a bit of time now. The Villa game's its own separate proposition. We'll talk about that in a minute or two. Unless Van Dijk or Gomez are much closer than it's being acted as though they are, and I just don't believe that. I think he does need to buy at least one. I think the reality of Matip with reference to back-to-back games, to me, I think if you wanted to, I'm fine with Fabinho against the bottom 10 being an option at the heart of that defence. In that, against the top 10, I want him to be an option at the heart of that midfield. And that's the key thing here. If it's me right now, I would love to see Liverpool find a pathway, as I said before, to doing something that's short term, something that's longer term, so that they're able to go into the rest of this season with three centre-halves, Matip plus this other two. Fabinho there is a really live option, especially if one of the other two isn't the best in the world by any stretch of the imagination. But being able to move Henderson and Fabinho back into midfield, I think, is something that he just needs to have, as much as we're talking here about the heart of the defence, ironically.
Yeah, I think it's absolutely crucial. I think everything you've said there is 100% spot on. I agree with everything. They're all my own thoughts on it. It's I've always been in the position that, you know, January is difficult because whoever we need to buy needs to buy somebody that's going to be long term. It can't be somebody that would the first player we buy can't be somebody who we're buying for a short term fix. It can't be a Stephen Colker. It can't be that, because that would make no difference. You might as well just have Nat Phillips there. We need to be looking. If we had somebody lined up for next summer, we need to be moving for them now and paying the extra if need be. But what we need is a centre-back who is going to compete with Joe Gomez on a permanent basis, who, when Van Dijk, possibly a younger player, somebody early 20s, but of real quality, who, when Van Dijk is coming towards the end of his time at Liverpool, can be the natural successor anyway, but needs to be part of a very solid three, who are your first choice three that you can rotate permanently if you have to. I'm not sure who that is. I know the names that are being mentioned are Upamecano, who I'm obviously mispronouncing appallingly. Kabak seems to be the main two. Although Sven Botman's agent is doing a lot of stuff to push his name forward. But it needs to be somebody who can be there for when Gomez is injured. I don't believe for a second Joe Gomez is injury prone. He just has a tendency to suffer catastrophic injuries. So it's not the lad's fault that he gets bad impact injuries. He's suffered from it. We don't know how he'll come back. We don't know how long it'll take. We don't know what player he'll be. We could need somebody who is going to be the next Joe Gomez for us already. So we need to be buying somebody of that quality who's ready for the first team, then somebody else for the bench. I think, as you said, it's absolutely crucial that Fabinho moves back into centre mid, because with him as the pivot of a three, then you've got that movement, you've got that defence, you've got the protection for the back four, and you've also got a passing range that is completely undervalued amongst people, because he's a fantastic player of the ball, and he carries brilliantly. He can move us up the field, and you give Henderson in to actually create the dynamism in midfield again. We can solve a lot of the team's problems by just buying the right centre-back, who would effectively be the second stroke third choice. Again,
Matip finds himself, Paul, in a situation. He signed an extension. He's got a contract till 2024. It's 2021 now. It's worth pointing that out. He's 30. So we've got Matip for the rest of his career, if we want him. If we don't, we can move him on. I think the key sort of question at the moment is in terms of recruitment there, is what are Liverpool expecting from Joel Matip? Are they expecting to be able to do a number of games a week? Because all of a sudden, the thing we can say with certainty is there's a lot of fucking games. You look at the fixture list, there's a lot of games. There's a lot of games a week that, as we move in, we want to progress in the Champions League past Leipzig, there'll be more games per week. There's unlikely to be any gap in the league where we're able to say, well, we can rest people for a league game to deal with a Champions League game. There's going to be league games that Liverpool need to win, not just possibly to come first, but also because if the league continues the way in which it is, you can throw a blanket over them from first to sixth. You're as likely to come first as you are to come sixth. Possibly that could end up being the case this season. So, you know, it's not just the idea of you trying to win the title or not trying to win the title. It could be to confirm top four. My point here is Liverpool may well just need to be thinking about exactly how they're going to deal with the reality of Joel Matip being very, very good, but not wanting to put unbelievable physical stress on him. And that's not just one centre-half if you want to be able to get Fabinho back into the middle of the park.
Yeah, and I think it ties into the signing question. Mm-hmm. And I'd love to see the list of their criteria for signing players. Now, we've said for a long time, something that Klopp's got really done really well is signs good lads. Like, it seems to be very high up on the list that sign good lads. I think that something needs to be pushed up that list now is injury proneness slash how often are they available? And I think we saw it in, again, it's dangerous to read into these things, but just it was just this tone of voice and facial expression last time I saw him talking about Keita being out. And it was just like his face was a bit like, I'm a bit sick of this now, to be honest. Like, we all know how good he is. But if he's not available, what's the point? If he can never play more than three games, what's the point? And I think that applies to centre-backs more than anybody else. Carragher's a really good example of this. One of Jamie Carragher's, if you were playing top trumps, one of Jamie Carragher's biggest strengths was available all the time. Just always available. One of our mates used to say about Daniel Sturridge, and I used to love Daniel Sturridge and defend him. And he'd say to me, no, he's useless, mate. You might as well get rid of him. And I'd say, why? And he'd say, because even as your third choice striker, it's pointless. If when everybody else is injured, you turn to the backup and they're injured, well, it's a waste of time. It doesn't matter how good they are. And I'm a big fan of Joel Matip. I do think he's a phenomenal centre-back if he's fit. But there's only so many times in a player's career you can say if he's fit. Because he's not exactly what you're saying. He can't do the number of games we want to do. I don't know whether anyone said this since in the game he got injured was at West Brom. I've never in my life wanted someone to have been hitting the balls with a football so much in my life. When he was crouched down holding his groin, I was like, did he get it in the balls? I didn't see that happen. Oh, yeah, I hope he has. And then it's, no, he's torn something. That's a pity. I've never been so disappointed to discover that another man hasn't been hitting the balls, which speaks volumes about his injury record. So, yeah, I think we've reached a point. I'm with you all on the signings, but we need to sign someone who is permanently available and who is resistant can play three games in a week.
The manager has said Liverpool will do the right thing in the transfer market. Ian, there is a minor. Most absolutely 99% of the time, I am very much behind Liverpool doing the right thing in the transfer market, planning long term, being really switched on. Let's use this language around the right thing. It's part of what's got us to where we are. It's an important part of Liverpool Football Club strategy and plan. I think one of the issues now, and I mean this with the greatest of respect to the two footballers in question, it's been a long time since you're able to say most of the players in the league would improve Liverpool. But right now, I am genuinely of the view that most central defenders who are starting Premier League matches would improve Liverpool. And that's why this is a little bit difficult and why on being on the exterior of this conversation, not part of the club, not knowing the finances, I think it's going to be difficult for Liverpool supporters because Phil Blundell tweeted yesterday, I very much enjoyed it from Phil, that people say, just get a centre-half, get any centre-half, where do you draw the line? Would you have Mustafi from Arsenal, for instance? And being frank with you, Ian, I'd have Mustafi from Arsenal on loan. I'd like us to have a look at Tomori at Chelsea, who's fallen out of favour there, either on loan or look to see if we can get him at a cut price fee, where he's not being deemed good enough to play for Chelsea, but everything I've seen from him suggests he's got a really good brain, he's really quick across the ground. The point being here that we can all have our conversation, and maybe we will as we finish this off, where we would draw the line. But I would have Mustafi from Arsenal because I think Mustafi from Arsenal will be more used to us right now being coached through. He only needs to have a good 4 months. Bjørn Kvam, his career trajectory for Liverpool would be perfect for us right now. We could do with someone coming in, hitting the ground running, having a great 4 months and then going to shit. That'd be fine at the moment. And I think that this is the point, and this is where a few of us will, I think, end up at odds with the manager and with the club, where they'll say we want to do the right thing because that's what we do. But my definition of the right thing and their definition of the right thing might be quite different.
Yeah, I think their definition of the right thing is probably going to be long-term planning. And for that reason, I think there's every possibility, a high likelihood that we don't buy anybody in this window. But yeah, if you could get somebody on loan for 4 months who just doesn't fit in with the manager they're playing for at the moment, but can be a body at centre-back who can play roughly in the way we play, that would be fine. Because I think we are in that position where we just need somebody who genuinely is a centre-back by trade. Because our two holding midfielders can be great centre-backs, but they're wasted there. Why do it? Why take these players and limit the rest of the team when you could go, okay, 4 months, minimal wages. Or if there's somebody out there that we could do a Minamino-style deal on where you can get them so cheap that it doesn't matter if it doesn't work out long-term, you'll probably still get a profit on them when you sell them in 2 years' time. anybody like that would do it at the moment, because I think, yeah, a centre-back of any kind would actually be... improvements might be too strong a word compared to last season, but beneficial and improving on where we are at the moment. I think we do just need a centre-back who would fit there to get us to the end of the season. And, you know, that would... Dejan Lovren would be fine at the moment. He'd make mistakes, but most of the time he'd be fine. I would take a Dejan Lovren style figure.
The key part of this for me, Paula, is if you were to get a couple in, it is that idea of all of a sudden then you would have the best midfield in the world. And you'd be picking the best midfield in the world every single game, even with rotation. That you'd be able to rotate which best midfield in the world you want to pick this week. And that's what, for me, what's at stake here. I like the idea of Henderson at centre-half. I actually do still disagree, even in hindsight, even having seen the game with Paul about picking Reece Williams. I understand why Liverpool go where they go. But my point is, they go where they go because they are trying to mitigate which bit of damage they want. Whereas if you were picking, for instance, Lovren and Matip, then right now you'd be able to pick Lovren and Matip and in front of them have the best midfield in the world, at which point I think we'd be better.
And that's the problem. The problem is in fixing a problem that we didn't think we'd have, because who loses three centre-backs, we're actually limiting our options in other parts of the pitch. Exactly what you said, pulling players out of position in order that they're not doing what they do best. And so I will be very, very surprised if he doesn't sign anybody, purely because numerically we're struggling. I know Jota's out, and I know... But, you know, even if Jota had played yesterday, I doubt he would have done anything, because he wouldn't have got the service. So I will be very, very surprised. I think what he'll do is he'll do someone mid-range, and what he'll look for, that, and the statisticians and the injury people and this new guy, this is it this connection between recovery and performance?
Yeah.
So I think him and his team, they'll be doing stats on mid-range players, mid-range centre-backs who don't get injured. I think he's looking through Europe, through the Premier League, and whoever he comes up with, or whoever they come up with, or whatever options they're presenting to Klopp, they're presenting options of players with a good injury record. Because, as you say with Sturridge, what's the point if you can't play?
To sort of sum this up, Paul, I think this is quite... it's going to be... I think Liverpool, a lot of Liverpool's very good decision-making is because they rule certain things out quickly. They just say, we don't do that sort of thing, that's not for us. Why I think this could become a difficult situation is it does actually strike almost at the philosophical aspect of that decision-making, in that right now there's a lot of centre-halves who Liverpool would not look at for a variety of reasons or conceive of who could be possibly available for them, who would be an improvement on Reece Williams and on Nat Phillips. And Liverpool have got a big decision to make there, that whether or not they are prepared to compromise aspects, and it's really important to say this, aspect of the decision-making process and structure that's turned them into European world and English champions. Are they or aren't they prepared to compromise on that? And I don't think there's a thing here which we do as humans, which we presume that there is an answer, firstly, that there is a right answer, and secondly, that there is an answer that everyone will hold to. There's every chance that Michael Edwards wakes up today and thinks, fuck it. And then he speaks to Jurgen Klopp and Jurgen Klopp goes, no. And then there's every chance that Jurgen Klopp gets through training on Thursday and he rings Michael Edwards and he thinks, no, actually, Michael, you were right, fuck it. And Michael says, no, you were right, Jurgen, let's not fuck it. Honestly, this is what's brought us here. I don't think there's necessarily something going on where they're never mind at one with one another, but possibly even at one with themselves day to day, because this is what's brought them to where they are right now. This is what has been brilliant for them. No knobheads. We don't buy any dead weight. We don't create problems for ourselves further down the line. But my God, as I said before, if someone came in, was 7 out of 10 at centre half for 4 months and then was a fucking problem for 12 months, I'd take it right now.
Yeah. And you know what? I could talk about that one topic for an hour in itself. It reminded me of, I remember hearing someone in an interview last year, and he was talking about politics more, but it's appropriate. And he said he always just, when he was growing up, he just always thought somewhere there was a room of grown-ups who knew what they were doing. And then he said, I got to this point in my career where I was in that room and I looked around thinking, oh shit. that room doesn't exist. And that, your little sketch of that potential conversation there, I think is absolutely spot on. These are human beings. There isn't a right answer. And it's worth remembering that one of the reasons we got to where we are with this philosophy, as European, World and Premier League champions for the first time in 30 years is because we went to get a centre-back who our manager wanted, and we it got ballsed up for different reasons. And it'd be brilliant to go back onto Twitter from back then and say, what was the consensus then? And I would say the consensus was, buy another centre-back. And Klopp went, no, because my philosophy is this, and this is the lad I'm going to get, and we're going to wait for him. And then waiting for him, yeah, who knows? Maybe we'd have got better results in that short period of time that we did wait for him. But by waiting and sticking to the philosophy, we ended up European, World and Premier League champions. So Jürgen can happily sit there, maybe not happily, but he can justifiably sit there and say to us all, if he doesn't buy someone, I get it. Just remember that. The problem he's got is, and the world has changed as well, as we've discussed this in past shows in the last lockdown, like the world has changed a lot. So anxiety levels are through the roof anyway. And everyone's, there's probably a philosophical argument for the supporter base, for everybody's mental health, just to buy someone. Like, just for like the owners to sign it, to phone Jürgen and say, lad, look, John Henry saying, I've got a spare 10. I've got 10 million quid here. It's been in a bank account. I wasn't sure what to do with it. The missus might have wanted a new kitchen. Just buy a centre back. Buy one of these lads. Watch that.
Philanthropy.
That's what it is. It'll make everyone else, it'll make us all just feel better for a couple of months. It'll take us a couple of months for him to play, to look shit, for us all to realise, no, that wasn't a good idea. By then, the other lads are back to fitness or Matt back. You can just get through it. You can muddle through it a bit. I think right now, that's £10 million well spent.
Ian, finishes off.
Well, this might be a negative thing, but going on from what Paul's just said, I think the easiest thing we can do to calm everybody down, as you said at the top of the show, we're all waiting for the celebration together at the end of the season. We're worried because we can see it sliding away from us. Accept the fact that we're not getting a parade in 2021. Just accept that now.
Fuck off, Ian.
Our job is...
This isn't a motivational speech, Ian.
This is positive now. Our job is to win the league in lockdown. Our job is to win the league in the situation we're in now. And people have forgotten that winning the leagues is actually really difficult because City made it look easy, United made it look easy, we made it look easy. Winning leagues is difficult and it should be difficult. And we are still top of the league and people will go above us in the next couple of weeks in games on just because of games in hand. They will go above us, but we will go above them again because we have to play them yet. And we are still better than United. We are still better than City. We get the right players on the pitch. We will beat those teams. We've had the worst possible Christmas we could have for the first time in Jürgen's time at Liverpool, but it'll be fine. Just accept that in this current world, we will win the league again. And everybody will be happy then.
Paula, is Ian speaking sense? He's literally rained on my parade.
Well, you know, we've got to have something, haven't we?
Thanks, Paul.
I'm getting on a plane in 3 days. I don't know. We're damned if we do and we're damned if we don't. Yeah, I'm going with Ian.
Okay, excellent stuff. I think we're going to put a place. Thank you very much to Paula Murphy, to Ian Salmon, and to Paul Cope, to Peter Moore, and to John Gibbons. It's been the Anfield Wrap this week. I mean, this all gets sorted out. We didn't get to talk about Villa, but we'll talk about that on shows leading up to Villa. I think Liverpool could have a good go of Villa, keep what constitutes FA Cup dreams alive, perhaps. And it all gets sorted out if you just beat Manchester United, which tends to be a phrase that works throughout the entirety of Liverpool history. See you later.
Sports Social Podcast Network.